Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. You know, it's very ironic that we have someone as math-phobic as myself. Justin calls me a mathematician to introduce a program which is also about the beauty of mathematics. So I think it's a testament to the ingenuity of Christos Papadimitriou's new book, Logicomics, An Epic Search for Truth, that I found it completely compelling, and I know so many of you will as well. It's a really remarkable achievement. Logicomics is about ideas, passion, madness, and the fierce struggle between the well-defined principle and the larger good. And it's a really engaging examination of the elusive attempt to isolate the logical foundations of mathematics. You will meet mathematician, philosopher Bertrand Russell on the eve of World War II. He's giving a public lecture at an American university where he's confronted by some isolationists in the audience who demand that he explain how logic could justify participating in a world war. And he responds, "What is logic?" And we are off on this amazing story. One of the creators of Logicomics, it's a collaborative effort, is here with us tonight, Christos H. Papadimitriou, who's a native of Greece. He holds the Lester C. Hogan Chair at UC Berkeley. His research work is in the theory of algorithms, computational complexity, and game theory, fields in which he is one of the leading international experts. His books, Elements of the Theory of Computation, Computational Complexity, and Combinatorial Optimization, Algorithms and Complexity, are the standard textbooks in their fields. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has been awarded numerous honorary doctorates and other distinctions, among them the prestigious Charles Babbage Prize. And among other things, he's the author of a novel, Turing, which was published in 2003, and he also plays keyboards in a rock band, although it is at the moment defunct, but he tells me it's going to start up again very soon. And I feel very fortunate to have discovered Zlatan Damjanovic, who is a professor at USC in logics and philosophy, to be in conversation with Christos tonight. His research interests are focused on the logical foundations of mathematics, and he's currently working on a book in the philosophy of mathematics. So please welcome Christos Papadimitriou and Zlatan Damjanovic to the Allowed series. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Many thanks, Louise. It's a pleasure, a privilege to be here. Thanks for being here. I thought that I should start with a little chat about a topic that I find fascinating, and sort of I thought about it only the last couple of months. What are the intellectual roots? I mean, look around you, okay? You can't miss the computer. Where does it come from? I'll tell you my opinion, that there are three subterranean intellectual currents that gave us the computer. One is rather obvious, calculation. The other is fascinating, artificial intelligence. And the third is logic. Let me explain. Calculation. All civilizations, everywhere in history, they were constrained by computation, by calculation. Our current civilization is the only one who's painfully aware of it. Computation was always of the essence. Except that most civilizations, some of the most fascinating, successful, brilliant civilizations in history, were very poor in calculation. For example, as I show with the Latin numerals there, it's very difficult to add these numbers, and you don't want even to think about multiplying them. Okay. So the greatest advance in calculation was not the computer at all by a long stretch. It came by this man on the right, Al-Khwarizmi, who lived in Baghdad, wrote in Persian, and apparently came from Uzbekistan, so he's a hero in three countries. So what he introduced is easy to overlook because we learned it in elementary school. He introduced the methods whereby we can use decimal numbers to add and multiply, to do addition and multiplication. And this was an incredible revolution, comparable to typography, in my opinion. For example, without Al-Khwarizmi and his methods and his algorithms, that's why I call them algorithms, I think that Galileo and Copernicus and even Newton would be dead in the water. So calculation, I think, is definitely important. Then there was always the fascination with the intelligent machine, the sort of, you know, the dream, the vision of the intelligent machine. I have here the Golem of Prague. I have a hero of Alexandria and his steam engines. The chest plain Turk. And on the upper right, the dream is not always a dream. It's often a nightmare. This is 2001 Space Odyssey by Kubrick. That's famous HAL, infamous HAL, okay, the computer. So everywhere I talk about artificial intelligence, there's somebody who asks me, Professor, aren't you paralyzed of fear that one day we're going to be governed by machines? So, you know, I don't know where I found this, but I think that it answers the question. You know, so why logic? So let me tell you extremely brief history of logic. You know, it basically started with Aristotle. The second most important ancient Greek logician is this man, Chrysippus. He was not Greek. He was Cypriot of Phoenician origin. Unfortunately, little happened the next 2,000 years in logic. Okay. Until these two people, around 1700, Leibniz, great German philosopher and scientist, he had this idea of using logic in decision making, and so did George Bull later, who actually did something about it. He wrote the famous book Laws of Thought, which laid the foundations of modern logic. All these, you know, Aristotle, Leibniz, and Bull. Aristotle conceived logic as a tool. That's why the book is called Organum. As a tool for understanding empirical science, the methodology of empirical science. Leibniz and Bull considered logic as a tool for social decision making, as we would call it today. It was only later with this man, with the next Frege, that logic became an important instrument in understanding the foundations of mathematics. And with Boole, we are already in the second half of the 19th century, and this is mathematics is facing a crisis in the following sense, that people's faith in the eternity of the truth of mathematics was shaken by what is called the non-Euclidean revolution. Okay, that people realized that there are perfectly reasonable geometries around that do not obey Euclid's axioms. And this was a total shock for many people. For example, Cantor thought that this goes against some very basic principles. Then, on the heels of this sort of near disaster, came Georg Cantor, who started playing dangerous games with infinity. And for example, showing that there are many kinds of infinity, okay, incomparable between them. Suddenly, people, mathematicians, felt the ground shake under their feet. And then this man came up with a brilliant theory that in order to fill every hole and give mathematics a solid foundation, what you need is to extend Boole's algebra, so Boole's logic. And that's exactly what he did. This man Frege came up with a way to give logical foundations to arithmetic and therefore all of mathematics. And then Bertrand Russell, who is actually the hero of logicomics, comes up with his famous paradox, which punches a hole in Frege's work. And then with Alfred North Whitehead, they decide to fix it by writing this magnum opus, which took them 10 years to write, and it's much of a story in logicomics. Of course, Bertrand Russell is perhaps, not certainly the greatest philosopher of the 20th century because of Ludwig Wittgenstein, okay, who was his student but also his nemesis. He's a fascinating character in logicomics, I think. So, even though he went to Russell to study logic, he came out very much, in some sense, as the foremost critic of logic. Then we have the Crusader, the person who was pointing the way toward certainty, David Hilbert, the greatest mathematician of the time, whose rallying cry was, "We must know, we shall know. We must find ways to prove every possible theorem in mathematics." Until disaster struck, and the disaster came from this man in his 20s in Vienna, Austria, who proved a devastating theorem, showing that what Hilbert and everybody else was after was impossible, inachievable. The famous Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which basically says that no matter how hard we try, there are always going to be theorems in mathematics that are going to be devoid of proof, true statements that cannot be proved. So this is, in some sense, the darkest moment of the story, except that it's the beginning. So it's the beginning of the grand finale, because Alan Turing, by then in his early 20s, British mathematician and philosopher, was motivated to make Gödel's message even more negative, sharpen Gödel's negative message, and establish that not only there are theorems that have no proofs, but even the theorems that do have proofs, there is no mechanical way of finding these proofs. But in order to establish this, for the first time, he had to define what mechanical way means. And in order to do that, he had to come up with something that eventually became, which we now call a theoretical computer, and gave it the gift of universality, which is a speech all by itself. So I'm not going to comment on that. 10 years later, another genius, 20th century mathematical genius, John von Neumann, put together the first computer, and the rest, you know. That's the computer that von Neumann, that John built. What really makes this story extra fascinating is the human tragedy in it. All these people had terrible brushes with, and sometimes very uncomfortable encounters with insanity. For example, Gödel died schizophrenic. He died of malnutrition because he refused to eat out of fear that he's being poisoned. Cantor was manic depressive for most of his life. And even people like Russell and Hilbert, they both had schizophrenic sons. So they were. And finally, perhaps the most sad story of all was the man whom we didn't talk about in Logic Comics, so I only display a photograph of. That's Emil Post, a New York school teacher who did some of the most brilliant work in the field. He had independently discovered something very close to Gödel's theorem. He had independently discovered something very close to Turing's machine, except that he kept everything in his drawer out of insecurity. This man was also a manic depressive, and he died the most tragic of deaths. He was essentially electrocuted by his doctor. During electroshock treatment. But the most tragic of all these stories does not have to do with madness of the man himself, but the madness of everybody around him. That's Alan Turing, who not only essentially invented a computer, but also during the Second World War led the English cryptanalysts to break the Enigma machine of the German Navy. And apparently, many people believe that this was one of the most momentous events in the Second World War, it probably was critical for the war, for the Atlantic War. So this essentially national hero, 8 years after the end of the war, was tried for homosexuality, and basically was led, was pushed to suicide by court-imposed chemical castration. It's interesting that only 2 weeks ago, the Prime Minister of Britain remembered to apologize to Turing. Yes. Sorry about that, Alan boy. Yeah, shouldn't have done it. So this is the story we tell in Logic Comics. It's basically our point of view is Bertrand Russell with his traumatic childhood. Incidentally, Zlatan asked me why is Bloomsbury our publisher. Bloomsbury, as you know, is the publisher of Harry Potter. Okay, and when we chose them, we had dreams of Harry Potterdom, because after all, we are talking about a child who at adolescence discovers magic. Okay, the magic that Russell discovers is the magic of mathematical certainty through proof. Then, of course, Russell goes on to Cambridge, where he flirts with his future wife, but also does work. Later on, he visits Frege. He visits Cantor. He sees Hilbert deliver his momentous lecture in 1900. He decides to write Principia Mathematica with Whitehead, but also flirts with his wife. I don't know. Yeah, I know the select few of you who have read my previous novel Turing may wonder if there is a lot of sex in Logic Comics. Sadly, the only explicit sex scene that I could go past my co-author is in this page. It involves insects on the bottom. Keeps flirting with Whitehead's wife. Then enter Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein gets a moment of epiphany during the First World War. Wittgenstein's no doubt. Gödel announcing his result. The rise of Nazism. All this is told through a framing narrative that this is Bertrand Russell giving a lecture to an American audience while heckled by isolationists who are against American participation in the war. And so it's the beginning of September of 1939. And there is a framing narrative, a second order framing narrative, which is the team, the Logic Comics team, discussing and debating about their work, their point of view. There is a visit to the dark side of Athens. And of course, it ends where it should all end, in an ancient Greek theater, at the finale of a performance of a Greek tragedy. So that's all.
Christos, when you're not writing comics, in real life, you're a computer scientist. What do computer scientists do, and how did you become one?
Computer scientists, obviously, what they should do is invent, design a new technology. But there are some bad computer scientists like me who use mathematics to... What I do in my day job is I prove theorems about what computers can and cannot do. I hope it, you know, doesn't make sense to anybody. I'm not sure. Yeah, so you know, it once made sense to me. Yeah. So, how I became one? Complete accident. I was in the 1970s. I was determined to flee the dictatorship in Greece, and so you know, and I was a good student. Graduate school was the best option, and Princeton Computer Science was the only place that took me. Yeah, so.
Now the book is not really computer science. It's even though it concerns mathematics, it goes into issues that can best be described as philosophical. How did it occur to you to
switch to
philosophy?
How dare I think about philosophy? I said, yeah, you know, as Zlatan, as you know, is a philosopher. So, you know, as you know better than anybody else here, I mean, philosophy is sort of, you know, love of wisdom, you know. So it's only recently that philosophy became such an exclusive enterprise, okay? So, you know, all scientists used to be philosophers, right? I mean, I think that you know, unfortunately, there is too much science these days is done into extremely specialized scholastic way. But I think that in all fields there are great scientists who look at the larger picture, and their work and point of view can only be described as philosophical.
Why a comic?
We never actually discussed anything else. I mean, maybe I should tell you the story that I met Apostolos, my co-author in this, 8 years ago, and we had lunch. He had written a very successful book, Uncle Petros. He had read my book. He called me up. We met. We had lunch, and during the lunch, we discussed this story. Not planning to write it, but sort of, you know, we had. You know, the discussion and debate we have in this, you know, we had it in the first lunch, and basically we resolved it. Okay, so, you know, we found a synthesis, a compromise, so, you know, that we both liked. Apostolos was very much into comics at the time, and they knew this wonderful, brilliant artistic team that we actually collaborated with. I knew nothing about comics. So basically the first thing I did, I had a crash course. I mean, I spent a summer reading comic books, doing essentially nothing else. You know, reading them in a way that, sort of, you know, observing detail and structure. I thought I knew nothing about comics, but what happened last year is that I renovated my parental house in downtown Athens. And I found lots of stuff that my mother had kept, including my high school notebooks, my university books, and all that. And in that, I mean, there were a couple of, several notebooks that I can only describe as graphic novels. that you know, they were stick figures, but really there was plot, there was dialogue, and so on. You know, so I had completely forgotten that. I mean, you know, I was totally surprised to see that. So listen, I mean, you know, the comic form, the comic book form is has unimaginable possibilities. It's becoming more and more en vogue. I mean, you know, every year you see a few dozen really wonderful, fantastic, brilliant graphic novels. So listen, I mean, you know, in some sense, 150 years ago, in the middle of the 19th century, there was a crossover point, okay, that Emerson and Dickens were both bestsellers, okay? So, you know, in the sense of, you know, that up to that point, it was only poetry. Then the novel, which was considered a second-class kind of genre, became very popular with the English tradition. So, I mean, if you think about the few, so novel has dominated literature in the last century and a half. I mean, in 50 years, there is a good chance that there will be a new genre that is going to be dominating. And I think the smart money is that it's going to be graphic novels.
Are you saying that mathematics and science in general has become so complicated, maybe the only way to communicate to anyone outside are comics?
Actually, I mean, there is a lot of truth to that. I mean, there is. I don't know how many of you know Larry Gonick. Okay, so he's a brilliant comic book writer, who he's also a scientist, a mathematician. He has written some of the most clear expositions of many subjects, including computer science, including genomics, including genetics and statistics. You know, which. So there are many very serious scientists, you know, many prize-winning papers where you see in the acknowledgement section, and I thank Larry Gonick for helping me understand statistics that I needed for this paper. Okay, so you know, the comics is a great way to teach, I think, you know. But let me tell you, that's not the purpose of this. Okay, so you know, this is a novel. Okay, I mean, it's. Our purpose in writing it was not to teach at all. I mean, there is too much education in my life. Okay, so you know, I've been in university for 40 years. Okay, I want to do something else. I mean, when you write a novel, what you want to do is to captivate the readers. So you know, the readers. In some sense, supply their fantasies, you know. So you know, affect their dream life, you know. You know that's what you want, you know. We couldn't care less. I mean, you know, we had to explain something because otherwise, the readers would say, "Why are these people doing this?" Okay, so you know, we were interested in teaching a little logic, mathematics. Just because, as a narrative device, because it was narrative necessity.
Well, your story is the story of mathematical logic, and to many people in that field, the figures the characters that you have in your story are larger than life. They're heroes. They're gods. They're people who you name theorems after, and you read about. So it is quite a surprise to find some of these people depicted in the comic the way that you portray them. Many of them come off as not very pleasant characters at all. They're prejudiced, they're obsessive, they're deeply neurotic, extremely egocentric, insensitive to other people. And if one thinks about the image of logic as a subject. The most of us probably think of Mr. Spock from Star Trek.
That's right, right? Yeah.
And he just would not fit among these people. He is eminently logical. And they, you know, some of them are downright crazy. I mean, in fact, quite a few of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Wow. So how does this jibe with the image of mathematics and logic in particular as eminently rational?
Great question. What can I say? Logic and math is about rationality and utmost certainty. It could be that crazy neurotic people strive for this even more than the rest of us. That they are thirsty for certainty, rationality, and so they turn to what think will be the will give them some of that.
What attracted you to these particular characters? Did you what fascinated you about Russell?
Russell is probably one of the most fascinating figures of the 20th century. I mean, you know, he's a philosopher. He's a mathematician, very accomplished. Nobel Prize in literature. The peace activist that he became later. Famous ladies' man. Opinions about everything. I mean, also extremely opinionated. Very rich personal life, and very articulate, very fascinating, very well done, very cunning autobiography. Yeah, so.
What about some of these other people? What do you find interesting and attractive about them?
So, you know, one of the main themes of our story is the insanity aspect that I talked about and yet you brought up. It's fascinating that, when I remember in our first lunch with Apostolos, he quoted to me somebody I knew, Giancarlo Rota, a great mathematician and actually in some sense philosopher of mathematics, who was writing about mathematics. He was writing a biographical little piece about Alonzo Church. And in this, he mentioned that it cannot be a coincidence that more than half of the protagonists of this story ended up insane. He said that's a high percentage even for mathematicians. You know, so, this is actually true. It's a fascinating question, and in many ways, this was one of the aspects that drove us. You know, how can you explain this? You know, and I don't know. With Apostolos, we have completely different explanations. We definitely don't answer it here. I don't think we have an answer. I'll just give you one possible explanation. Imagine that you are a very gifted adolescent, very scientifically, very mathematically, extremely gifted. You also realize that there is something really wrong, terribly wrong upstairs. What do you do? Which scientific field do you choose? Maybe you are attracted to those fields that give you some promise of absolute certainty, of promise of stability, of rationality. And it could be that this is happening. For example, for Russell, we know because he says so, that it is the fear of madness that led him to mathematics and the foundations. In many ways, I think the story of the tragic story of Joe Nash that we watched in in a wonderful book and a weak movie. Could be cast in the same, could be cast, in the same way, because when Nash became famous, sort of in the beginning of the 50s, it was, the promise of rationality was in economics and game theory. It was the era of capitalism and Cold War.
So these are fascinating personalities, and as you say, there is a great incidence of extraordinary personalities there, more than in the general population, more than even in among mathematicians. But aside from aside from the personalities, they're all involved in a common project, and part of your story is this foundational quest. What is it about? What is the foundational quest really about?
This massive effort by mathematicians around the turn of the 20th century to put mathematics on a very sure footing, and redo what Euclid did 2,200 years later, like Euclid founded geometry on a firm basis, they wanted to expand this to all of mathematics.
You mentioned the impact of non-Euclidean geometry, so the time was ripe, right. For a new foundation. And some people say that, and you mentioned this, that the mathematics was in a state of crisis. Now, we think of mathematics as, by its nature, as organized, logically organized. How can it be in a crisis? And what is it for for mathematics to be in a state of crisis?
Mathematics is the queen and servant of science, right? Of sciences. The doubts that were everywhere after the non-Euclidean geometries and after Cantor's treatment of infinity, I believe that the clients, the sciences, were a little distrustful. You people cannot agree what is a parallel line. How can we trust you with our precious theories about nature? I believe that's one aspect, but as we know, even the most rigorous of sciences, go through periods of crisis and scientific revolutions and so on. It has to do with the current paradigm, which of course mathematics is always rock solid, but there is an ideology about what is important, what is worth doing, and what is not. When this is challenged, that's a crisis.
Do you think that that mathematics now is no less in a crisis than it was then? Or is it always in a state of crisis?
Can you talk? Is there any mathematician in the audience? Remember, I showed you Hilbert address in 1900 in Paris, the mathematical community. During this talk, Hilbert set forth 23 problems that basically set the agenda of mathematics for the next century. Progress in mathematics was to be measured by progress on these 23 problems, and all these 23 problems, at least those that could be solved, were solved. In the 1970s, the people who solved these problems put together a volume about giving the next generation of problems. And I lived through it, and an intense sense of disappointment came to me. Because I could relate, and I think anybody could relate, with every single one of the 23 problems that Hilbert posed. But I could not begin to understand. I was a mathematician, and I could not understand what was the questions, in most of these problems. So I think that mathematics, like all of sciences, are now in a period of intense specialization. It has to do with demographics. It has to do with the way science works. My field is going that way. I'm sure philosophy is going that way.
You make a connection.
Change the subject. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, let's stick to mathematics and logic. Yeah. Now you make a connection in the book with tragedy, and there is a suggestion that there is a tragic element to this entire story, to this entire enterprise that these people found themselves in by virtue of their common temperament and by virtue of their sort of common preoccupations. And in some way, you see them as tragic heroes. How so?
They are tragic in the broad modern sense, because they live lives that are both grand and sad. They're tragic in the Aristotelian sense. I consider this a tragic story in the sense of Aristotle, who thought that tragedy means hubris and catharsis. There is the hubris that we shall understand everything in mathematics. There is the mess of Gödel's incompleteness theorem, and there is which in some sense is and in our book, this tragedy proceeds in lockstep with the tragedy of Europe and the first half of the 20th century. Gödel's theorem, in some sense, is the end of optimism, in a more general, the Nazism is on the rise. It's a century that started all hope and brilliant intellectual achievement is taking a different shape. Of course, the last important part of a tragedy in the Aristotelian sense is a charitable compromise delivered by a machine, actually, right? I think that the connection, the sense in which this is the prelude of the computer, one of the most important elements of the 20th century, I think. Even though some people now believe that the computer is totally insignificant, it was just a little gadget that came to usher in the internet. Okay, and that's the important stuff. Okay,
Just to Set aside for a moment the theme of madness. There is another angle to the story. Most of these characters were, as founders of modern logic, they were intellectual dissidents of sorts. Their ideas went against the accepted norms of thinking established by the mathematics profession. So do you see any analogy to religious heresy or perhaps political dissidence?
That's a great question. There must be a wonderful treatise there. The same kind of minds, who are irreverent enough to rebel against the way science is done. To rebel against scientific discipline, are the same ones who rebel against dogma, authority, and so on. That's an interesting conjecture. I wonder what were the, obviously Russell was politically highly unorthodox. He went to jail for as a peace activist during the First World War. He went against orthodoxy both of the left and the right. I wonder how the other heroes. What were the political? I don't believe that we have any testimony about the political beliefs of Gödel. Gödel, actually, I don't know if he. I don't know how many of you know this famous anecdote. Okay, but in the 50s, Gödel decided to become a U.S. citizen, and back then, what you have to do to become a U.S. citizen was you have to have an interview with a judge, and you had to have two witnesses who are already U.S. citizens. And as his two witnesses, Gödel, who lived at Princeton, chose Oscar Morgenstern, who was one of the greatest economists of the 20th century, and Albert Einstein. Morgenstern was driving them to Trenton for the interview. Gödel volunteered as part of his preparation for the interview, he had to study the U.S. Constitution, that he found several contradictions for example, he found a way that dictatorship could be imposed in the United States. They spent the whole ride with Oscar Morgenstern and Albert Einstein trying to convince him that it's not a good idea to tell the judge his findings. And Gödel was not convinced. He said, but wait, that's his job. Maybe he wants to know. And Albert would say, no, Kurt, you don't understand. It's not a terrible idea. I think they convinced him by the time they arrived at Trenton. So Gödel obviously also had some political social irreverence, but of course it was fueled by his logicism.
Well, one great thing about the comic form is that it brings out the human interest. It brings out characters. It portrays these figures as real people with their passions, their worldly concerns, and that's a very different picture of science, and perhaps when it comes to mathematics, that's even most striking. Very different picture of what goes on in the development of a science than we get from textbooks. From textbooks, do not give you any idea about who these people were. They often don't even mention. They even drop the names of people, so you don't really have a sense of the human drama that is behind the making of real science.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
So is it your sense that a comic might be just the right form to communicate something that just is lost in textbooks?
So I think the comic is a very extremely powerful form, and definitely for the purpose you mentioned, in order to give the story and the drama behind scientific fields. I really think that so this is sort of another hat and sort of of mine. There is some kind of movement now that to put back into the teaching of science, especially mathematics and computer science, the element of narrative, stories. In some sense, narrative sort of is a cognitive category that is extremely attractive to the human mind. So if I tell you in quick succession a pristine logical argument and a nice good story, you are going to remember the good story. So they are premium brain fodder, and it's a pity that we don't use them much more. So, for example, when I'm, I wrote a paper whose title was Mythematics, like as in myth and mathematics, I proposed that this is the way we should go. So I always tell a story. If I don't find a relevant story, I tell them a joke. Okay, so, I always cut, my lectures, and several times, I mean, let's face it, 50 minutes is too many minutes, okay? And 80 minutes is an eternity, okay? So I think that we'll have happier students and smarter students if we tell them stories.
Well, at a private university, tuition is $50,000 a year. You want really to be telling them jokes on this 50 minutes? That's what they're paying for?
I've thought to explain. I know what you mean exactly. Yeah. So. Yeah. They will not tell their parents. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think it's time for us to then to open the floor for questions. Gentleman there. And
there. You mentioned at the beginning that your work during the day involves proving things that computers can't do. Can you give some examples of that?
Certainly. So what computers do is solve problems, some problems have proven to be hard even for the super fast computers of today. For example, you can't solve them even by the fastest computer within the lifetime of the universe. I'll give you a very simple example. Imagine that you have 100 cities on a map, and you want to and you have the distances between the cities, and you want to find the best tour, the best way to visit each one of them and return where you started, the shortest one. You can definitely do it by examining all of them, but there are too many of them. And this is called a traveling salesman problem for some reason. And so, the world's smartest mathematicians have been trying to develop algorithms, computer methods to solve it for that over the past 50, 60 years. And still the best methods we know are of the kind that are not for prime time. They don't work. They don't. So a lot of us are thinking, why is that? Is it because we're stupid and we don't find good methods? Or there is something terribly wrong with these problems? Okay, so we're trying to prove that these problems cannot be solved faster than astronomical time. And many of you have, this has become now a very famous problem. It's called P versus NP, P equals NP. I don't know, many of you must have heard of it. You know, so that's what it's about.
Gentlemen.
So you've been describing the tragic element of the failure to find these sort of ultimate grounds of certainty and resolve things, you know, the way that their grand project was envisioned as a sort of tragedy. But if you think about the story as from the perspective of different contemporary fields, and you think about the role that the work done at the turn of the century in logic has had on contemporary philosophy of language versus the stage-setting work that it did to bring about computer science through the work of Church and Turing versus the actual project to, like, you know, solidify the foundations of mathematics. For some of those stories, it sounds like an optimistic stage because it was a huge turning point in contemporary philosophy, but it, in terms of the logicist project, it was sort of the extreme failure. So did you have to omit some of those perspectives in telling the story, or did you try and balance them the way that you see the overall balance in general?
I'm glad you asked this question. So the second, you know, I mentioned the second order framing narrative, which is the Logicomics team, mainly Apostolos and I, arguing back and forth about several issues. One of them is Apostolos wants to see it as a tragedy. And I am trying to convince everybody that there's an incredible number of good things came out of that, and so on. I mean, so yes, this is at the center of this second order narrative. Okay, so which this discussion we had at our first lunch. Okay. And it lasted 10 minutes. I mean, no, but we dramatize it here.
The lady, yep.
I was wondering if, by any chance, you could illuminate something. I was told that at one time it was believed that massively parallel computers would not be possible. Why was that?
Massively parallel computers, I think, are inevitable. The way that computers computing technology goes right now, the computers will become more and more parallel because of constraints. Okay, they have to be. I think the question that we are asking is: can we take advantage of?
Why was it believed that it would not be possible before it actually happened, that there would not be the possibility of massively parallel computers?
So I think that nobody doubted that massive parallel computers were possible. I believe that people doubted that they can be effectively used. Okay, suppose that you can put together a very powerful machine consisting of many computers, but basically only one of them can work. Okay, so this was the fear, that they will not be able to be effectively used, and the reason that people fear that, and there are some grounds to that, is that we live a sequential life, we live in a sequential world, and we are not used to thinking and programming in a massively parallel way. So this is one of the important intellectual enterprises within computer science. It's an ongoing, and actually it has been revitalized in the past 3-4 years. Because of natural constraints, computer manufacturers started again creating massively computer, this time within a chip.
Sorry. Gentlemen there.
Can you tell a little bit about how you collaborated with the artist in doing the comic?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, we tried hard. To download a particular video that actually, you know, if you go to YouTube and search for Logic Comics, there is a very nice video that the story is that very capable Greek director became fascinated with the book, and he created a nice film out of that. And the film now is available on YouTube. Actually, it showed in some theaters in Greece. So how do you go? And it explains, it all is explained there. We had, it was a little like subsistence farming. Okay, so we worked for 2 weeks and then waited for 6 months. Okay, these pages, every two pages, took a week of the artist's time. Okay, so a chapter was many months. The way we did it is we invented a particular notation where we said row one, panel one, three panels approximately equal, and so on. I mean, so we had a very rigid notation. I mean, actually, we show some of that in the film. Towards the second half of the chapters, we decided that this form of communication was not the best, was not the most effective. And so what we did, after Apostolos and I wrote a chapter, we sat together with the artists, and we did what we called patatology, which was sort of basically meant that we made rough sketches of stick figure sketches, if you wish, of each page, on a board and all that, and we worked for 2 or 3 days this way, and then they went off and did their thing. But yes, I mean, obviously, this is a major problem, and we had to address it. We had to find the initial solution and then rethink it often.
Gentlemen there.
This comes from my interest in both architecture and computer science. Do you draw or diagram in your computer science work, and how useful do you find that relative to mathematical notation?
Let me tell you. Geometry is paramount in my work, and there are many drawings in all of my work. In mathematics, this is definitely part of the exposition of mathematics. We don't have rigorous ways of drawing. I mean, a very interesting aside of this is that the first person, Gottlob Frege, who came up with logic, his notation for logic was a highly geometric one. But people got freaked out by it. I mean, it never caught on. You know, it was Russell and Peano who came up with today's notation in logic. But you can't beat Frege's notation for aesthetics. It's really fantastic. Yeah.
Gentlemen here.
If I may, two questions. One, how did you choose to create this in Greek first and then English? And second, what do your literary colleagues at the university tell you about computer science?
So we did not actually. We wrote it first in English, but our Greek publisher was too eager. So we decided to do it as a pilot publication. We translated it, actually Apostolos translated it into Greek. The reason is that we hired, you know, the publisher hired somebody who translated, and we didn't like what happened. And I tried to convince him to ignore it because we're not going to see the Turkish or the Dutch or the Norwegian translation. Okay, so you know, but why should we care about the Greek one, especially? You know, but he spent his summer of 2008 translating it, retranslated, and so it appeared. So we translated, we wrote it in English, and then it was translated in Greek. What was your second question? Oh, yes, right, yeah. So, I haven't heard from them about my literary activity. I don't think they teach my novels in their courses, but there is going to be an event at Berkeley, a similar event where there is the mathematics department, the English department, the philosophy department, and the computer science department. Sort of, you know, and then I'm going to listen to them, and I'm not looking forward to it, frankly. Yes.
Okay, there's one question from here. Would you please?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was wondering. Because you skirt very close to it, the concept of Platonism, if you thought of expounding that, and also maybe theories that come very close to philosophy, like Weinstein gets very close to problem of consciousness and the Penrose idea of the Gödel being setting a limit on AI.
Yeah, Yes. Yes. There is. So let me focus on the last aspect of what you asked, which is a fascinating question. I mean, it's probably more in Zlatan's court than mine, but famous physicist. British physicist Penrose wrote a book 12 years, you know, a dozen years ago, claiming that Gödel's theorem essentially proves that there can be no artificial intelligence, that there are limits. So, I think, you know, there is. I don't agree with what he says. You know, maybe his end conclusion is correct, but his argument is completely. I cannot follow it. There is a book I forget. I mean, it's a Norwegian author with. All the abuses that Gödel's proof, abuses and misunderstandings of Gödel's proof, you know, Gödel's theorem. You know, when you prove something so intellectually attractive as that mathematics must forever be incomplete, okay, you are inviting abuse, okay, you are inviting misinterpretations and false applications, and there have been many of them. I think that Penrose is one of the latest.
We have time for one more question. Gentlemen there.
Looking at your book, I didn't see any introduction or any writing in the beginning, like a prologue, except one word, overture. Is there a reason for not having anything introduction to the book? Any reason?
Yeah. So, in some sense, the first page of the book is very much an introduction to the book. I mean, it's, you see you see one of the authors holding the draft book and sort of and discussing it, sort of, you know, with serious existential doubts about it. So the book starts with the second order of framing a narrative that I mentioned before. So that's self-referential one enough. And so, you know, we didn't think that we need any more introduction. When you write a comic book, by the way, it's a cop out if you start with words, okay? Because
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.